Hello, you're listening to CJLO 6090 AM. This is Shaking the Habitual with a bit of a South by Southwest preview show because I am joined on the show currently by Carson Henderson from Truck Violence. How's it going, Carson?
Not too bad. How about you?
I'm pretty good. We were talking a bit before the show, so we've gone through a bunch of the interview questions already. But I caught you recently at the M for Mothland show, and you played in the middle of the floor of like Salarosa, and it seems to me like Truck Violence is very much so a playing in the middle of the floor kind of band. Like, do you think that like energy resonates with like the kind of live performances you want to give?
Yeah, definitely. One of my biggest gripes with playing venues is that there is sort of a partition between the crowd and the performers, which is something I typically don't enjoy. I hate the separation. Especially those really tall stages. I just feel like I can never get in with anybody, which is why I prefer outdoor shows. But yeah, no, the degrees of separation do bother me, which is why that was a really fun show.
Yeah, because you give like you're very, very active when you're on stage. And that often involves like going out into the audience and like dragging them into the performance itself.
Mm-hmm.
So like, how do you, I guess, get ready for going on stage like that? What's the kind of way you built yourself up to like that mindset?
I mean, it just comes with the music. I think that it's really important that you ought to believe in what you're doing. You ought to believe in the words you're saying and the sort of feelings that are incited from your music. There should be almost an ease to it, where it's like you get on stage and I'm almost practicing what I preach. My lyrics and the music is all incredibly earnest and incredibly, like I had said before, like it's conversational, and I would be remiss not to have that conversation with people. And in those performances, that takes the place of literally grabbing them and pulling them in and yelling in their face, and they can yell back in mine. And it's like, that's what it's about. It's not about just watching a band play. It's about experiencing something together.
Yeah, we were talking earlier, and you said, I think if you play a show and people walk away of it thinking like, I just saw a band play a show, you kind of think you failed because you didn't reach this conversational level.
Yeah, exactly. I think that at a time where everything is hidden behind countless layers of, you know, whether it's irony or performative aesthetics, it's like, it's kind of your job to be earnest, whether that's bad or whether that's good. I want to feel like people saw me through all of the ups and the downs, whether that's at a low point where I'm doing poorly and I'm nervous, or when I'm aggressive and I'm frantic and, you know, whatever. It's like, it should be real, and I invite them to feel it along with me, or for something more interior, to feel almost like reading a book or reading a poem. It's like, how does that make you feel? You know, I'm doing this. How do you feel about that? And then we can sort of interact in that way.
So we were talking about how important that back and forth is to art as well. Like, where it's not necessarily that the message is meaningful because it makes this meaningful connection within whoever is in the audience or like observing.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the reason why it tends to sound so abstract when I'm talking about, you know, what makes a meaningful performance is because, as with any human experience, I don't think that it can be boiled down into one thing. You know, there isn't one thing that makes a good show or a good song. It's every element that created it is inextricable from the piece itself, and it's like, it's complex. You know, you would never read a poem or a story and say this is about this thing. It's like, it's about so many things, and it can be about things that are almost in conflict with one another, and that's just like the nature of the human experience and art. And I think that this goes to my broader critique of a lot of art on social media right now, where they're trying to essentialize the experience into one thing. It's like, I am this thing, and isn't that cool? And it's like, no, it's not.
Yeah. Well, like, just judging based off like your album and like the show that I saw, there's kind of a rhythm and tempo to your performance and the album itself, where it is a hardcore album, kind of, in parts, mm-hmm. and then it is shifting into this really stripped down folk, and then it's shifting back and forth, and it doesn't really settle there. Do you think of like a narrative structure when you're like performing, or when you're like putting together like an album and stuff like that?
Yeah, of course. Everything is sort of self-contained. And yeah, I want to feel like I'm telling a story. Albeit there are times in that album that I think I was a bit of a sloppy narrator. There is some charm in that. I mean, a lot of my favorite albums, you know, there's moments where it's like, you played that wrong. That transition was bad, but I love it. And I think there's an element of that charm in this last album. But yeah, I don't want to feel like I'm just, look at this cool riff, and now here's another cool riff, and isn't that cool? It's like, it's been done, and it's not interesting to me. And I want people to walk away feeling like, okay, I'm taking from this what I would take from an extremely jarring story, you know?
Mm. Yeah, so, like, music with a message.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, all music technically has a message, but it's like, how are you saying it, you know? And what is it? That's sort of the most integral part.
So the lyrics you write are very meaningful, meaning dense, I find. Like, they are poetic and like literary. How do you find that? I guess, and you said in an interview that you consider yourself a writer first and then a musician second. How do you think that like music as medium affects that writing? How does it transform it?
Well, I think that it does change it, but only it's very circumstantial. I mean, if you look at the history of poetry and how it's been sort of popular in the past, a lot of it has been through oral presentation. It's a very new phenomenon that we associate poetry just on the page, something that we read, whereas in the past it's always been to music. It's been a part of something else. It's visual, it is oral, and so I'm realizing now, because I didn't when I was younger, that poetry on the page is kind of like a fish dead in the water right now. Like, nobody's reading it or interacting with it, and we're not pulling anything from it, and we have this beautifully large industry that is music right now that is so popular. It's like, why am I not using this? Why am I not putting my poetry to music? Because that's sort of like, it's the way to do it right now. People are listening, they're not reading. Put two and two together,
you know? Yeah, it's got to, performance is the way through, I guess.
And it does change what I'm writing, because how I will write something on the page, I necessarily have to then change it when I'm speaking it, and there are additions and there are things that I take away, and it's like, that sounds stupid when it's read out loud, and this doesn't convey that, and so I'll change it to this, and it's a whole process. But yeah, I wouldn't consider myself a musician as much as would the other people in the project. It's just like, they're literally playing an instrument, whereas I think that, you know, are my vocals musically complex? I don't know.
Well, one of the things I did notice is they are clear. Like, the words themselves are like clear and legible, and that's not a thing in every single band. It's like, they are meant to be heard.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Of course. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and so in my mind, that's like a musician's talent, is to make something heard within a larger mix.
Sure, yeah. I think that, you know, you could argue to the degree of how much of it is musicianship or not. And I think that there is an element to it. I guess, like, I used to play a lot of drums when I was younger, and the way that I would practice drums it is similar, but it is very different to the way, I don't even know if it's that different. This is something that I would have to think about more, but like the way that I would craft a beat, a percussive sequence, there is something that is different from the way that I would write, a poem and speak it. But, on second thought, there is a lot of overlap. So that is to be determined, the difference.
I also wanted to talk to you a bit about, like, the role places and locations play in, I guess, your conception of truck violence in general. Like, you recently dropped your album on vinyl, and there's two editions, and they're both named after places, Plamondon and Conklin, which I assume are deeply meaningful places. In the album notes, you mentioned that it's like an honest look at countryside life, the Canadian countryside. Like, how much are you thinking about like places and locations when you come up with lyrics for Truck Violence?
It's everything. Location is such a broad term, because it's all encompassing. When I think of one of my childhood homes, it's like, it is not just visual, it is also, the types of birds that would chirp, and the sound that the rain would make when it would hit, whether that's vinyl siding or whether that is the metal trough like window that I had. It is sound, it's visual, it is everything. And so I think of poems in a very similar way, where it's like I'm trying to build a scene. I take a lot of inspiration from symbolist poets, where it's like a bunch of images that are loosely connected and they're sort of flitting, and in the end they weave themselves together, even though they might be disparate things that aren't necessarily linked traditionally. They still come together to paint an image and to paint a scene, and that scene incites some sort of feeling or thought. And that's why locations are so important to music, to poems, and I think that they're sort of one and the same, right?
CGL 1690 AM. This is Shaking the Habitual, and a very special episode today because we are joined by Carson Henderson from Truck Violence. You just heard his song. That was him singing. He ended the bender hanging before the break. We were talking about outdoor shows when we were off mic. You've played a lot of outdoor shows. Has there been any moments of like that stood out? Like, what are your favorite locations?
Favorite locations? I mean, we've played some rather interesting spots, and it would be really hard to peg a favorite. But I think that the most important part of any good outdoor location is a location that is totally subversive to the concert hall. Almost unworkable. Like, the more unworkable the location, almost the better it feels to play there. I could provide two examples. We played for, I think, our second single release. We played near Frontenac Metro by a highway, in just some grassy patch. And it was raining, and we put umbrellas over all the gear. And it was just, it felt really nice to do that, because it's like, it's different. And anytime anyone thinks of that show, it's like we associate it with this place that probably will never get played again. Like, that was the one time. And I think that that's really cool, because it makes the concert almost feel like it's its own piece. It's not just another show at Turbo House, where how many shows you see at Turbo House? And it's like, it's another Turbo House show, okay? It's its own particular thing. No one will ever do that again. And that's just what it is. Mm-hmm. And I really like that.
So, a show that makes its mark on a specific piece of, like, a specific place.
Yeah,
exactly. A specific time.
Sure.
Yeah, would you ever consider doing, like, a winter show outside?
Yeah, I would love to. I would really love to. We were planning on doing something this winter, but we're just so busy that we can't really swing it. But another time. Another time would be cool. I think as Canadians, we can tough out the cold a little bit, put our winter jackets on, and
play a 30-minute set, or maybe a bit longer, but I don't know. You're also talking about this way off, this like trade-off that you have of like actually getting people out to these events and like the subversiveness of the location, because yeah. It can be kind of tough to get people off the beaten path some of the time.
It is a difficult thing. I mean, I say this as like a local musician. So, you know, if I was Metallica, you know, it wouldn't be so hard.
Yeah.
But this is an interesting calculation that you have to make when you want to run these sort of subversive shows where there are barriers. I mean, we know that people will do what is easy and not what is hard. That's just like pretty typical. And it's like, yeah, if you're a 45-minute walk from the metro, assume that your effects are going to be exponentially diminutive. And it's like, sometimes you just got to bite the bullet on that. And the people who will come will come, and they'll enjoy themselves. And that's okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it's... but it's there. There's also something in there about like the unique location and the unique performance. Because I imagine each performance would like conform to that too. So they're like the appeal there is it like it's not just another Turbo House show, for example. It would be the show of this place.
Exactly. I think another really cool thing about running outside shows is that you're really interacting with your environment. I think all too often concert halls look like every other concert hall, you know, a concert hall in Sweden and a concert hall in Montreal. Show me two pictures, I promise I'm not going to be able to guess which country is which. But you know, these are things that we walk past every single day, that are part of our lives. And I think it's really cool to, you know, as artists who make their art in these locations, to really put them there and contextualize them. And it's like, I wrote this here, and this location has a piece, has a place in what I wrote, and you have a place in what I wrote and in this concert. And I think it's just this cool, harmonious affair that you don't see all too often. And there's, it's almost a little extra cool because it's like, you're not even allowed to do it. It's like, we're not even supposed to be here, so we're cool, you know? And it's great. I love outdoor shows.
So speaking of like music from a place, Truck Violence kind of has two places where it's this rural countryside, Alberta, Conklin, outdoors. It's in your music videos. You can see it. It's like a very different from the Montreal landscape. And then it's also like the Montreal landscape and all the outdoor venues here where like you can see, it's like maybe like trackside or underneath the overpass. How do these kind of interact and form like is there like a tension or a contrast there between these two environments, or is there, what are the harmonies between the two?
You know, there's so many. Yeah, I spent most of my formative years out in Alberta, and so coming here was quite the culture shock. And there's stages to culture shock, you know, whether that's leaving and coming. These are two different things, you know. I think when I left, I hated where I was from. And then as I got here, I was like, okay, now I love where I'm from. And now I hate this place. And it's like, slowly the pendulum stops swinging so much. And there are loads of harmonies. I really do like Montreal. I really do like the opportunities that I am afforded because I am here and because I was there. I think that now more than ever, it's important to have a sort of pragmatic patriotism. You know, I think that negative messaging has just never been super successful in making people make good changes. And so you can be critical, you can be pragmatic, but I think a lot of what I've learned is like, I love being in Canada and I love being Canadian. And there's a lot of tension even in that, just as there is tension between going from the rural to the city. There is a lot of conflict in being pragmatically proud about where you are and what that means for you, you know?
Yeah, it often gets, it like, I find that this love of place and love of location often gets really misinterpreted in like the with the wider scheme of things, because like on the small scale, you can really love a place and want to play homage to it, and there's nothing wrong with loving a place very deeply. It's because it's ultimately like, you know, we are settings in one way or another, and you know, you gotta like, you gotta you know, be happy for part of life.
It's, yeah,
yeah,
of course. And I think that you can love critically, and you ought to love critically. When you love critically, you want to see changes and you want to see things get better. You can't only engage in the negative all the time. That just isn't a sustainable form of contribution. I always thought it was super funny that a lot of people thought, because of this sort of, you know, there's like almost a very big like almost patriot ex prairie look to what we do, and a lot of people take that as me being or us being very conservative, which we're not at all. I'm extremely progressive, and I think that it's weird that you can't, you know, love the land and love aspects of culture and what that means, and not come across as like being conservative. That's like a weird thing that I think that we're losing out on as progressives.
Yeah, there. So like, as one thing that I do notice in Truck Violence, in your music videos, in your lyrics, in your music, it's there's a very much so like an anti-romanticism. I think a lot of the times what makes people conservative about loving things is loving them how they were back in the past, this made up past, like we got it, we must go back to, and but like that's not what Truck Violence is. It's very much so like a look at what it is, just plain and simple.
Yeah, exactly. I that is my favorite part about the prairies whenever I talk about them, or even my favorite parts about Montreal. It's like it is unforgiving, and it is beautiful, and it is harmful in a lot of ways, you know. And I think to where I grew up, the fields, the trees, the fences and the sort of faded farmwood, it all has a sadness to it. It all feels a bit bygone, and I love that because it makes me think of myself, it makes me think of my family, it makes me think of all these things that share that sort of bygone, faded tinge. And yeah, it's important not to just blindly love something and assume that it is something that which it is not. And that's why I love, you know, prairies and places and things.
Yeah, I imagine you must think a lot about like post-industrialization, like what was there and what is not there, because so much of the landscape has been shaped by that here in Montreal and out in Alberta. It's a lot of the most I guess the most iconic images are of these things that aren't for the place anymore, or were for the place, like runes and stuff like that. Yeah, how much time do you spend thinking about like post-industrialization and those sorts of symbols?
I think that it doesn't necessarily take a deliberate place in my mind, but it does take a place, and the effects are still ongoing post-industrialization, especially in the prairies. You see it. I mean, every time I go back home, it's like these sort of satellite towns where industry has sort of receded, especially with within the oil and gas industry there. It's like there are so many general stores that are closed down in these small satellite communities that had some life in them. You know, they had a gas station or something. They don't even have that anymore. And it's like, they're just sort of dying, I guess. And what's going to happen to them in 25 years? You know, I want to move back to the country when I'm older. And is there going to be a country I can go back to? I don't know. You know, maybe with remote work, that'll change things. But it's a weird feeling.
But yeah, but it is very, very tough out there, because like, especially like, well, the fires themselves are like very much so remaking the landscape as we speak. And it's, it's interesting that you say you ultimately want to go back and live out in the countryside when you're a bit older. Is that because you like feel drawn to it in a way that it like it kind of has to be there in your life?
It's just a different way of living. It's very slow. There's just infinite time, it feels like, to mull things over. And whether that's maybe me remembering being a child, and being a child is a very slow, dripping process. Maybe that is the case. I'm a bit rosy, you know, colored on this, but it is very slow, and I hate how fast everything feels right now. It's like there's just so little time to pick something up and just chew it and chew it and chew it, and I want to do that again someday once my need for opportunity is sort of dried up.
Mm-hmm. I'm joined on air by Carson Henderson. Carson, it's been a pleasure. We're going to keep this interview rolling and talk a little bit about your upcoming tour. Truck Violence is hitting the road, going to America. You got 4 dates in New York and 3 in Austin?
To be determined, yeah. It's always in flux, I suppose.
Yeah, so off mic, we were talking a bit. There's going to be a bit of a change to the live performance. Are you looking to keep that as a surprise for everybody, or do you want to go into it?
I don't think anyone who's going to be at South by Southwest will necessarily keep this in their recollection anyway. So I think we're fine.
I'll be there.
So. Okay, well, there you go. So you already know the surprise. It's okay. Yeah, no, it is sort of a really weird time to be going to the States right now, because there's such a sort of antagonism between Canada and the States. And yeah, it feels weird to go there as a Canadian. And I kind of want to be antagonistic as well. Be like, you know what? I guess I can't swear, but you know, you can assume what I was going to say.
Lean into antagonism.
Yeah, exactly. So that'll be a really strange experience. But you know, the States isn't a monolith, and I mean, the elections were won by what, like less than a percentage point difference. So it's not like I'm going to only a room full of,
like the Republican National Convention.
Yeah.
No, stop there.
I'm not going to CPAC. That's for sure. But, you know, it'll just be an interesting thing. And, I definitely want to play into that antagonism, because I feel it. I do feel it. And you should feel it. You should feel it with the current Trump administration. You should feel it really intensely. You probably do. And you should also feel it back home with the next elections in Canada. I mean, you should be so engaged and tapped into trying to do everything that you can to make sure that Poilievre does not win the next election, and to make sure that, you know, Trumpism doesn't get a foothold into Canada. I think that's like an important distinction to make. Like, we are not going to make those same mistakes.
Yeah, because just all this talk about like the tariff, which is back in the news. It's apparently rolling out March 4th. It does seem like it's a weird turning point for, I guess, this country in its relationship with the United States, which is kind of, we're standing on the precipice of something, and it's, I would understand why that would like very much so impact you as a, I guess, a Canadian head stateside.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we could never pretend to know what this sort of new age imperialism that the Trump administration is purporting, like what is the reason for it? Not even the people in our government understand it. Not even the constituents in the States understand, you know, why Greenland, why Canada? Like, this just seems also absurd. Who knows? The point is that it's being spoken into existence, and it's not good. And it's not good that there are, you know, the sort of dregs of that here in Canada, in the Conservative Party and in the constituency of the Conservative Party. And I think that we should work hard to change that.
Yeah, hypocritical. These people who think they know Canada better than anybody else, but they want America in a can here. It's truly this a strange worldview and mindset.
It is the age of post-truth and anti-intellectualism and anti-institutions, where there's just no way to get a hold on this. And, you know, the funny thing about bringing this back to the prairies is there's so many people that I know back there that, I mean, don't, especially people who are a bit older and even younger people, we lack the media literacy to critically engage with our phones to the point where, you know, I'll have people who believe in, you know, governments creating hurricanes to hurricane their own people, or like super prevalent where I'm from, actually. So many people tacitly believe in like these awful, awful conspiracy theories. And it's because they're just being shot with this information all day through their various social medias. And it's like, yeah, it's crazy that people believe this stuff and they go into the real world and will actually enact the things that they see on their phones and put it into practice. And it's just like, damn.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a crazy time to be alive.
Yeah. But I imagine like South by Southwest and New York is probably going to be a lot though for you too. Like the shows themselves.
Yes.
It seems like it's going to be like a whirlwind tour too in this like strange environment. Like, I don't know if anybody in the United States really knows what's going on either. Stepping into the storm, it feels like, I bet.
A little bit. It's also our first time playing outside of the country straight up. And like I had said before, this is sort of like the showcase festival ringer a little bit, where it's really difficult and you have to work really hard and you're getting good opportunities, but you don't necessarily have like the luxury of comfort while you're sort of going through this gauntlet. And so it is like a stressful thing. It's an exciting thing. It's difficult, but you know, you hope that you come back and it was all worth it. So I guess we'll see, you know, who knows?
Yeah. It's, I was talking to Alex Ferns the other day and he mentioned that La Securité, when they went down to South by Southwest last year, played something like 16 shows or something like that. They picked up 16 shows, so it can get intense. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm imagining you're looking to pick up some shows while you're down there as well.
Yeah, I mean, as much as we can play, we'll play. You're there. Why not, right? Yeah, it'll be a really interesting experience. It feels sort of vindicating, I suppose. I mean, as an artist, you want to feel like you're in some sort of constant progression in an industry where there is no path. You know, you go to university and you do... You follow the infrastructure and you come out the other end and you know what you're going to do, roughly.
Yeah.
With music, there are no such steps. And so things like this feel like vindication to somebody like myself.
I think you're right, but because, you know, when people believe in the music, that's when things like South by Southwest, that's when something like a US tour, this is when the showcases start to happen. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't know, speaks to like, I guess, the meaning within the music that we were talking about earlier. There's a message there that people are finding and resonating with.
Hopefully. I mean, you know, it's like, I've learned to never count my eggs before they hatch, or chickens before they hatch, out of the egg, something like that.
Yeah.
Point is that I've been burned many times by like exciting feelings in music, and it's like, okay, you know, I kind of, my bar is set low, and I'm like, if I come away feeling okay, then I won.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit. So yeah, I don't know.
CJLO 1690 AM, this is Shaking the Habitual. I'm joined by Carson Henderson from Truck Violence. Carson, how's it been so far? Is this your first radio interview?
Yeah, although I ran a radio show in my hometown when I was younger.
Oh, cool. So. Yeah. What station was it with?
Boreal FM.
Oh, cool.
I don't know. It was in Plamondon, really small town. We ran a radio station starting at like 9 p.m., and we were supposed to be playing music that is like French. It was a French cultural center, and we would just play like grind music and just say that it was French because nobody could understand the lyrics.
Yeah. I like playing like 47 songs an hour or something like that because they're all 20 seconds long.
Exactly. So I have been on the air before, but this is the first like interview. Yeah. It's good. It's fun.
That's so cool. Night DJ with like being a night DJ and playing grind music. Is that like, were you part of like, did you have like a co-host and stuff like that?
Yeah, it was actually Paul, the guitarist. We were in the same town.
Yeah.
And they were just like, we ran the studio in that center because they had no one else to run it. And Paul watched a lot of YouTube videos on recording. And so he was an expert, actually.
Yeah,
well, from YouTube videos, of course.
That's how you get there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you two go way, way back.
Yeah. Since the start of like middle school, pretty much, he had moved to where I was. And it was like, okay, finally. And yeah, we did that radio station totally unsupervised at like 15 or 16, which is like, not a good idea. We played some garbage on that station. There must have been some farmers that were not so happy here.
Yeah, but honestly, I'd be happy to have a grind show on CJLO. that'd be so sweet. Yeah.
As would I.
Yeah.
As would the world.
So you and Paul, like, you've been creative partners for a while then.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much only made music together ever. Actually, every project I've ever played in, anytime I've ever made music, has been with Paul. And I foresee that'll be the case probably until we stop. I don't know. It's like one of those things where I don't know if I would want to make music if he wasn't there. I just feel like it's something that we do together. And it's like our shared experience, and I wouldn't want to jump into something without him, I guess.
Yeah, but that's great. It's like you found, I was reading an interview that you have very different creative processes, where Paul is very much so music focused. But I imagine it really works for you.
Yeah, it does. We pick up the slack where the other person sort of is lacking. And I think that we have a really special bond insofar as just our socialization was just so particular. I don't think that we work so well with a lot of people. I think that we are very particular people and very fickle and grew up in these extremely weird ways. And so just kind of works. Which is funny when I talk to other people, because especially in Montreal, the classic, everybody's in like 7 or 8 different projects with 7 or 8 different groups of people. I could not imagine doing that. That would be very, very scary to me to just make music with random people. I couldn't,
Yeah. I have a couple of friends who are just in everything.
Yeah.
Like, once accidentally, you just find out people are playing shows tonight and they're like, oh, you're in a band I've never heard of before. But that's a totally good way to approach music in general. Go make as much as you want. But Truck Finance seems so focused right now. And it's like very, very deliberate in what you and Paul are doing together.
Yeah, it is really deliberate, but in a way that is natural. Paul is just such a strange, he's such an enigmatic person. He's really simple on the surface, but really, really complex and hard to understand. And I think that's just what's so lovable, is that there's just always something else that doesn't make sense. And you can see it in the way, especially you'll see it in the next record, the way that he writes is just so strange. He can't play straight. He can't write anything that is not almost unintelligible. And then our job as his partners is to sort of reinterpret whatever unintelligible spiel he made on the guitar. And then it's like, okay, well, we'll write the song about that. Now I understand it. And I think that's a beautiful process. It makes me happy to do it.
So you mentioned the new record, and I have to ask, how's it coming along? Is it, how's the songwriting going? What can people expect?
It is. We just finished all of the writing for the band portion, which means the record's like probably 70% done at this point. I love it, and I think that it is just such an evolution and so much better than the last record to me. So much better, infinitely. And it's different also, which I like.
So probably coming out sometime this year then, if it's 70% of the way along.
It's definitely coming out this year.
Do you have a date?
There is a relative month. There's no date. I would say like early fall will be the tentative time you can expect it to be relatively out.
All right. Well, we'll have to have you back. I guess that about does it for our hour of radio, but thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
I really, really enjoyed this. I'm going to send us off with one of your tracks. This one's Drunk to Death.